This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Are you interested in the unknown?
Video games.
Old movies.
Horror.
Old TV.
Zombies.
Fantasies.
Comics.
The paranormal.
And science fiction.
Hot TV.
Games and more. Then tune in Tuesday night at 10.
On Sci-Fi and Squid.
On Joy 94.9.
Tom Ripley.
Tom Ripley?
We were at Princeton together.
Did we know each other? Sorry, what is it?
Ripley.
How do you do?
We'll just be for a little while.
No, I like him.
Marge, you like everybody. Marge, you like everybody.
You stay at Dickie's house, eat Dickie's food, wear his clothes,
and his father picks up the tab.
What did you actually do in New York?
Telling lies, forging signatures, impersonating practically anybody.
Terrible distraction.
Yes, but it's like something out of a heady wine or something, you know.
Did I know you were Princeton, Tom? I don't think I did I?
I always thought it'd be better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody.
Why is it that when men play, they always play at killing each other?
I feel like I've been handed a new life.
I wouldn't have cared what anyone thought.
Have you ever fallen in love?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. What is love for you? What is the concept of love? What does it mean?
It's kind of madness. Not very logical.
Man-eating snails is another.
Oh, the snails! Yes, the topic of the snails. Yes. There we go.
Which I mean,
what was that about?
Beginning of her career in the 1950s and 60s, I think she felt it would have been kind of box office, in a sense, suicide if people had known she was a gay writer.
And very influential. I mean, you wouldn't have things like the very pop culture of Dexter and those sort of characters without. And Thomas Harris may not have done what he did without something like Patricia Highsmith's work. To ask. Are you a bit of a horror fan?
Yeah, no, I've always... I mean, science fiction are probably, science fiction probably more than horror, but as a kind of, you know, you can't avoid being interested in horror. If you like, you know, science fiction, you like crime fiction, then you kind of have to like horror as well, because it'd be a bit bizarre if you didn't.
This is Sonia on Sci-Fi and Squeam here on Joy 94.9. We've got someone special in the studio. We're speaking to Adrian Wootton, who is over here for the Melbourne International Film Festival once again, but he's doing a very curious discussion about Patricia Highsmith from Strangers to Ripley. Welcome to the show there, Adrian.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here, actually. And you were saying this is might be the fifth year you've been.
That's right, yeah. I've been coming now for a few years here to the festival. It's great. It was a pleasure.
Well, it's certainly growing. Do you think it is? Do you think from your experience that MIF is getting bigger? Or?
Yeah, no, I think it is. I mean, certainly from the times I've been here, I mean, the audiences seem to be growing. The festival seems to be getting more popular, more recognised internationally as well. So it definitely seems to be doing really well.
Very good. For you, I mean, you are a person who has an extensive extensive background in film and perhaps more the academic side and the business side of things as such. What can you tell us about?
Well, I guess, yeah, it sort of divides in two. I mean, my day-to-day job running Film London, the British Film Commission, is very much sort of, you know, business, sort of industrial side of things, to try and encourage people to make movies in the UK and help young filmmakers to commission low-budget films, to do training programs. And then on the other side, a long history of writing about film and curating programs about film at the British Film Institute and lecturing and doing work with festivals around the world.
Yes, I noticed that looking at you online, your role in various festivals and, of course, with BFI, and I must admit, they have a fantastic online presence, to be honest.
Right.
Are you involved in that side of things?
Well, I'm involved in it insofar as the fact that I'm surprised about the amount of stuff that I've done for them over the years that's on there. Kind of on stage interviews and presentations and things. Yes, my you know, at least a part of my history is there on BFI Online.
No, it is fabulous for us. Well, to see that they have been playing some horror films in recent times, so quite involved there. We have to ask, are you a bit of a horror fan yourself?
Yeah, no, I've always, I mean, science fiction are probably, you know, science fiction probably more than a horror, but as a kind of can't avoid being interested in horror. If you like science fiction, you like crime fiction, then you kind of have to like horror as well, because it'd be a bit bizarre if you didn't.
Yes. And there is a science fiction they're looking at the moment.
Yeah, there is. And the BFI has actually got a big science fiction program coming up later this year. It's kind of several months of science fiction programming, which is all quite exciting, that we're going to be doing stuff around.
Busy person, and now here in Melbourne for the International Film Festival. Now tell us why the topic of Patricia Highsmith?
Well, I've always been a real admirer of her work, and when the festival said to me, what subjects would you like to look at this year, Highsmith came to mind, because I knew there was, you know, there's some new film adaptations, Two-Faced of January at the most recent, and I've always been a huge admirer of her work and think she's incredibly kind of influential and important as a writer.
Yes, I think so, but that's probably what, in the last 10-15 years, well, within the last 20 years, that we've seen it become, you know, something that people are more interested in, and her stories and tales.
Yes, I think so. I mean, she, you know, she had quite a long career, but it was very kind of up and down in terms of public response and in terms of films. But it's interesting, I think, that since her death in 1995, I think people have recognised more. There's been more written about it, more biographical work done, and I think people have recognised just how important she's been to the kind of genre, you know, and filmmakers keep on drawing on her work for a kind of inspiration. And writers cite her as being incredibly influential. I think that, you know, she is a true kind of original, and her work isn't easily bracketed. She is kind of a crime writer, but I think that you would say she's much more a kind of suspense and a writer about the macabre, you know.
Definitely
her work tips into the kind of into the horror and the fantastic.
I mean, I think with the Tom Ripley series, and, you know, that's been Hollywoodized, and that's probably what most people are aware of.
Yeah.
But of course, there's Strangers on the Train, looking back at Alfred Hitchcock's version of that, and fabulous work.
That's right. Strangers on the Train was her first published novel in 1950, and it was amazing that Hitchcock adapted her first book into an incredibly famous film literally the year after it was published. So she got this incredible boost at the beginning of her career.
Yeah.
Although she didn't have anything to do with the film version, but then what happened over the years, as she wrote and wrote quite prolifically through the 1950s and 60s, is that more and more filmmakers wanted to adapt her work, and Ripley, Ripley novels have constantly been, you know, both on in film, but also in different European television. There's been television adaptations of Ripley as well, and he, as a kind of slightly strange, lovable psychopath, has become an incredibly popular character
and very influential. I mean, you wouldn't have things like the very pop culture of Dexter and those sort of characters without, and Thomas Harris may not have done what he did without something like Patricia Highsmith's work.
Yeah, I think that's what is the kind of key sort of hallmark importance, is that she was never interested in the traditional, you know, good and bad. She was interested in the kind of moral grey area. She was interested in the bad guys. She was much more interested in anti-heroes, in existential kind of outsiders. You know, the influence on her were very much like Kafka and Dostoevsky. She was interested in in the concept of evil, and people who could be on the surface incredibly ordinary and at the same time commit shocking acts. And, yes. And Ripley is that character. Ripley is that character who has, in a sense, no moral compass at all.
Mm.
And yet we are drawn to him. We're kind of fascinated by the fact that his only morality is one of survival.
Yes, very popular idea, I think. Yes. It's become something incredibly fashionable for writers, and she certainly has finally been recognised much, much later. But I haven't seen the Two Faces of January myself, so what do you think of that one?
Well, I think it's rather a good adaptation of the novel was written in, I think, 1964, and so it's taken a long time for this to make it to the screen. But with the cast it has of Oscar Isaac and Viggo Mortensen and Kirsten Dunst, and it's shot in the kind of authentic locations that the book was set in, because she spent a lot of time travelling around Greece and Italy and France, and it replicates absolutely beautifully those books' locations, and I think it captures that sort of macabre, amoral atmosphere of Highsmith rather well. So actually, I think it's a good entry in the Highsmith film canon, and the first one for a little while. So it seems to be encouraging others, because I we've now got Todd Haynes making a movie with one of her novels as well for next year. Yeah,
that will be interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, the look of it, the production design of his films alone are fascinating. So for you, obviously this is something you're passionate about, and you're going to be doing this talk at the Village Roadshow Theatreette this Friday.
That's right.
Right. How are you going with that? You prepared? You ready?
Yeah, I am. I mean, the talks tend to be the talks tend to be an attempt to kind of make accessible in terms of both the career and the importance of the writing, but also to look at the different film and television adaptations, and hopefully to tell people stuff that they don't necessarily know about what went on beyond the making of those films, and also what went on in Highsmith's own life and her kind of quite complicated and fascinating and largely kind of unknown, because she kept her personal life very private, even though she recorded pretty much every detail of it in extensive notebooks and diaries, which had then become available to biographers in the years since she died. But the talks are not just, they're very much not me standing there and just pontificating.
Yes.
There's a lot of clips. I think I'm showing clips of 10 movies. There's a whole kind of slide photographic show of images from her life and her work and the film adaptations. So it's very much a kind of visual experience as much as me kind of talking. And so it's not an academic experience. It's meant to be a really kind of inclusive thing, which hopefully people come out of thinking, I haven't read that book, I'd like to read that book.
Yes.
I haven't seen that movie, I must get that movie, and I didn't know that about her. That's, if those things happen, then it's kind of worked.
Yeah. Well, you kind of have to do that full sort of, immerse the audience with all the visual things and tags and so on. I think that's expected these days, but that will be fascinating. What are the 10 films?
Well, the different films that I talk about, I mean, obviously there's over 20 odd adaptations, film and television ones, but I go back to Strange on a Train and then work through all the European, a number of the major European films, the René Clément 1960 first version of a Ripley adaptation, Purple Noon. I talk about the adaptations of Deep Water that was made in France, and this Sweet Sickness, with the wonderful Claude Miller film from 1977, and the famous German film adaptation of again another Ripley novel, American Friend by Wim Wenders, which I love and she hated. In fact, she hated a number of the film adaptations.
Yes, I was about to say, from what I've gathered and read about her, she wasn't very happy about any of them.
No,
as far as I'm aware.
No, I mean, the thing is that she was the money that the movies brought.
Yes.
And she had kind of flirtations with screenwriting. She wrote a television play for the BBC in London in the 1960s. And she had abortive attempts where she was commissioned to write screenplays. And she also agreed to work with certain directors on screenplays. But they never really worked out. And so her involvement in the movies tended to be about, you know, her agent contacting her and saying, Columbia Picture wants to make this. You know, they'll pay you $20,000. Is that okay? And she herself really had very little actual script writing or creative involvement in the adaptations. But she had got quite strong opinions on them. I mean, the René Clément version, 1960, Purple Noon, she loved Alan Delon. And actually, she thought Alan Delon was the perfect embodiment of Ripley in a way that she didn't feel any of the following actors that embodied him were. And she, you know, some of the movies she saw and a lot of the movies she didn't go and see. And as they say, she had a very particular viewpoint on film. And she, you know, there were some versions, I mean, the American Friend, the Vin Vendors film, which she admitted that after she'd watched it a couple of times, she kind of saw what Vendors was getting at with the book. But when she first saw it, she absolutely hated Dennis Hopper as Ripley and thought he was completely wrong and the film was a disaster. But she was a woman of very, very strong opinion, and she could be very vituperative. If people got on the wrong side of her, she didn't suffer fools gladly. And because also she liked to drink, she could also be pretty kind of violent in her reactions.
Aggressive in some respects.
That's right.
Yes, I guess for us, it's also the LGBTIQ part of it, the queerness and her sexuality, what was known about it. Open, closed, kind of closeted, but at the same time, it was well known about her sexuality and the complexity of that. Do you think, from your point of view, that had any influence on the writing?
I think it did have a profound influence on the writing. Obviously, she did write, for want of a better word, a kind of lesbian populist novel, The Price of Salt, also known as Carol, which she wrote under a pseudonym in 1952, very early in her career. And it was based, to a certain extent, on an incident in her own life. And she, you know, the last book she wrote at the very end of her career was also a kind of queer novel. And she wrote several unpublished books that had kind of gay characters. And so it was incredibly important to her. But although she didn't go out of her way in private in any sense to conceal her kind of gay identity, in public, in terms of her as a public writer, in terms of interviews, certainly in the beginning of her career, in the 1950s and 60s, I think she felt it would have been kind of box office, in a sense, suicide if people had known she was a gay writer. And that was why her publishers insisted she write under a pseudonym. And I think that whilst she only wrote a limited number of novels that were explicitly about gay characters, I think the themes of identity and repression of identity and what constituted real individuality were incredibly important to her work. And I think a lot of that kind of, frankly, that kind of frustration and repression of her real life was projected into her most famous characters. And Ripley himself is an androgynous character in many senses. And she talks about his sexuality in a very ambivalent way. So I think she projected her own interest in sexuality and the complexity of the way she negotiated it herself into her work. So I think queerness, for want of a better word, was an incredibly important part of her identity, profoundly important. Gave her enormous kind of problems because she veered from being quite vehement in her personal life about it to being kind of quite repressive about it. And I think it reflected her time, you know, being a gay woman trying to make a career in the 1940s in McCarthyite America was not easy. And I think that, and the fact she had a very difficult childhood and a very complicated relationship with her mother, you know, formed some of the most profound difficulties of her own personality, but also fired her creativity as an artist.
That's the key, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
End of the day, look, terrible childhood, very difficult what I read about, and the boarding school experiences, and it just seemed to really scar her permanently. But without that, we wouldn't have had some of this work that elevates her, in my opinion, more than, say, your average type of crime thriller writer. It does make the difference, and you feel that stamp of difference in her work.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think that she lived, in a way, to be a writer. She had a very tortuous, turbulent personal life. I think she went through enormous crises of confidence, of personal identity. She was a very restless person. She was constantly traveling.
A lot, yes.
And she moved all the time.
Like, I believe she got fed up and hated America for a while and settled in Switzerland, wasn't it? And
well, that's right. I mean, she moved a lot locations. Around. I mean, she grew up to a certain extent in Fort Worth, Texas. Then she lived in New York. Then she was writing comic book stories in Mexico.
Yes.
She moved from Mexico back to New York. Then she basically, when you get into the kind of early, mid-1960s, she moved pretty much to Europe. And then she lived around the Ile-de-France area, around Fontainebleau, and she moved loads of different times around France, and then eventually moved to Switzerland and lived in a number of places before she finally settled in
She settled there, yes.
Yeah, in Switzerland for the rest of her life. And there was also a period when she lived in London, and she lived outside London in England. But she was constantly moving house, and frankly, either sharing houses and then falling out with friends or lovers,
yes.
or they fell out with her, and she would sell the house and move in with somebody else, and then that wouldn't work. And she had this very restless existence, but also, I think, frankly, a very kind of tormented existence in terms of, because she never, and she was constantly writing about it in her diaries, this sort of personally tormented existence where she never could sort of settle down with one person.
Ooh.
And the only thing that really kind of drove her on and gave her absolutely a singular person focus in life was writing.
Yes.
And when she was doing that, she was happy. And that was when she was at her happiest.
Interesting. Oh, great. I would love to see somebody do a television series about her life. That would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, HBO or someone like that, no, AMC.
Because it's certainly a kind of history of a particular, you know, somebody who took all of that, the real complexity, the real contradictions, and some cases suffering, and fused it into these extraordinary books where she basically pushed the boundaries of what was acceptable in terms of representation in creative fiction. And she wasn't bound by the cliches of the genre. She was always trying to break out of those cliches. And I think that's what makes her book so special now.
Mm.
And also what drew filmmakers to her, because they could see that she was doing something no one else was doing.
It's quite a cinematic experience, because she's like an eye. You're like looking for a keyhole into people's lives who seem quite normal on the outside, but then there's these dreadful events that happen and you realise these people have no scruples whatsoever, and it's all about, I guess, a dog-eat-dog sort of experience.
Well, I mean, she, you know, when you think about the way in which she talks about, where she kind of rips up the kind of, in a sense, polite society and the sort of veneer, the surface of things, to get beneath it and suddenly expose what people are doing in terms of forgery, murder, betrayal. And also, she looks at subjects which, again, people hadn't really incorporated in the same way. You know, the whole of the Sweet Sickness is about a stalker, you know, and somebody who becomes, you know, he's got a romantic fantasy of somebody that doesn't really exist except in his own mind. Mm. And she explored pathology and people's psychological peculiarities with a depth that I don't think very few writers have ever been able to match.
Yeah, she was certainly, I think, probably one of the most significant writers for fiction, no matter what sort of genre it is, for the later 20th, you know, mid to 20th century, of course. Now, for you, doing this particular, you know, discussion and event that's coming up with the Melbourne International Film Festival, if you had a choice, what would you say was the highlight so far of any adaptations of her work in cinema?
I think there's been some terrific adaptations, actually. I mean, Strange on a Train is not faithful, exactly faithful, but, you know, starting with Hitchcock, that's not a bad way to start into the movies. And I do love the René Clément film version of The Talented Mr. Ripley. But also, I mean, I mentioned the Claude Miller film from 1977, This Sweet Sickness, which is one of the early roles from Gérard Depardieu, and is absolutely fantastic. Captures that atmosphere of Highsmith, that tension, that suspense, that sense of a world out of kilter, really brilliantly.
Okay. Now, for our listeners, what would you suggest that they start with if they're looking at, look, I can't read the books, but I want to see what she's about in film?
Well, I mean, I think if they want to see what she's about in film, then you know, as I say, pick any one of those movies. In fact, the René Clément has just recently been re-released in a beautiful Technicolor restoration DVD, so you can get that and look at it, and it looks fantastic. But even, you know, I mean, the Anthony Minghella version, which came out in 1998, is actually a remarkably good and authentic version, and because it's got Matt Damon and Jude Law and Gwyneth Paltrow, and it's very glamorous and good looking, you can kind of ignore its virtues, which his virtues are that it's pretty faithful to the book. And I certainly always say to people that if you want to start, I mean, the great thing about Patricia Highsmith is you didn't write very long books. They're packed, yes, they're concise, yeah. So you can pick up Strange on a Train and read it very quickly. And there are five Ripley novels, but reading The Talented Mr. Ripley encapsulates her whole kind of writing style, her brilliant kind of imagination. So you can pick up one of those books quite easily, and certainly watching any of those movies, I think, will send you back to the books.
There seems to be, yeah, it's very similar to Richard Matheson's style, I think, as far as the length of these books. They're kind of like a little bit Pulp Fiction in a way. Not putting it down for that, of course, but just the, I guess they're quite accessible and quick to read, like you said. And I've read some of her short stories, which are very, very short, thinking like a page and a half for some of them, about supernatural cats and very bizarre topics like that.
Gigantic man-eating snails is another.
Snails, yes, the topic of the snails, yes. There we go.
Which, I mean,
what was that about?
Well, she loved snails. Yes. I mean, this is the thing that, you know, she loved cats and she loved snails. In fact, I think she loved snails and cats more than she did like most people.
Yes, I'd say so.
And she kept snails and she kept cats. And snails inspired her to write some of the most macabre, which they blur into kind of science fiction and horror.
Yes, they do. You know,
gigantic unusual man-eating snails. You know, so snails inspired her, as did cats.
Cats, yes.
And it was, you know, a consistent passion throughout her life, because I think she found, you know, I don't know about snails, but she certainly found that she had more loyalty from cats than she did from people.
There you go. Well, for all those cat ladies out there, this writer's for you. Yes, the snails. I heard all about how she had to go through customs once, hiding them in her bra.
That's absolutely right.
Or brassiere, as they would call them.
She did several trips across with the snail stuck to her. Yes.
Oh, there you go. All sorts of ideas come from that, doesn't it? What would Jung and Freud say?
Yeah,
but she would know.
She
anyway.
Would. She would, yeah.
And she'd probably go, what the hell, if people don't like it? Yeah, carry on.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, look, it's fabulous speaking to you, Adrian, about, something I think that's pretty special, and it's great to see a writer like Patricia Highsmith, a woman writer, a lesbian, and a curiosity as well, but definitely talented, having some recognition, and it's fabulous that you are doing this great event discussion as such. I'm not sure what they call them. Do they call them hubs? What do they call them?
They call them talks. I mean,
talks. I'm trying to think. Hubs, talks, events. Yes.
Yeah.
And so that's this Friday, Friday the 8th of August, 5 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. It's a good time at the Village Road Show Theatre, part of the Melbourne International Film Festival here this year, 2014. So I hope you have a good time there.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
You taking any props, any snails? Or?
No. I thought about that, but I thought, you know, it's a long journey from London to Melbourne, you know, with the snails. So
you don't want to get arrested as well. It's probably $100,000 fine or something.
It probably is, yeah. I mean, because they constitute food, I think, you know, it's, you know, agricultural products.
Coming from France, yeah. Wonder what the French thought of that. Anyway, look, thank you so much for speaking to us, Adrian. Adrian Wooten. Great.
Take a look at that view. It was here. King Aegeus looked out to sea, waiting for his son to return. Another victim of the cruel tricks gods play on men.
No, thank you.
Mr. Dunleavy?
I think you get the wrong one.
I represent some very unhappy clients. I'm just here for the money.
Chester?
Oh, God.
Everybody should have one talent. What's yours?
Because not all geeks are the same, and not all queer geeks are the same.
Queer geeks are us.
Because allies are important, and because you can like Batman and Spider-Man.
Queer geeks are us.
Because Professor Oak doesn't know how to politely ask which pronoun you prefer, and then goes on to assume you're cisgendered anyway.
Queer geeks are us.
Because we want to explore stories and worlds as characters other than straight white dudes.
Queer geeks are us.
Because we want to explore stories and worlds as characters that represent ourselves.
Queer geeks are us.
Because we want to explore stories and worlds as characters other than ourselves.
Queer geeks are us.
Because we want to see what it would look like if we put Tumblr on a stage.
Queer geeks are us.
In Melbourne, Hobart, Brisbane and Sydney.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.